My three siblings and I all live in very different worlds from our mother. None of us stayed in that Chicago German Jewish world, which barely exists anymore. We don't live near one another. Only one sister still lives in Chicago, a Chicago my parents didn't know, and her grown children live in North Carolina. I'm the only one of the four who is married to a Jew. None of us live in suburbs. We live in cities in the country. None of us has ever remotely considered joining a country club. We each have a few friends from childhood, but they aren't in our daily lives except through the phone and email.
Welcome to Book Tour. I am Netta Ulibi. NPR's editorial director of digital media, Dick Meyer, joins us this week with his new book. It's called Why We Hate Us, American Discontent in the New Millennium. Meyer draws a contrast between his life and community and that of his parents. He's troubled by what he sees as an increase in rudeness, vulgarity, corruption, and getting ahead at others' expense. Meyer believes the U.S. started slipping from individualism to narcissism in the 1960s, a decade otherwise celebrated for positive social change. Dick Meyer's reflections can also be found in his regular column for NPR.org. It's called Against the Grain. Meyer is a longtime newsman for print and television who worked most recently for CBS News. This reading of Why We Hate Us was recorded in August 2008 at the Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C.
Thank you. That was very generous. I think the fundamental observation of why we hate us, and I would say it's an observation because it's really not the kind of thing that you can prove through iron logic or social science. But the fundamental observation of my book is simply that most, and I believe most is the right word, of the people who live in America today feel somehow allergic to the prevailing culture, to the politics, to media, to Hollywood, to Wall Street, to Madison Avenue, to K Street, to the law, even to the clergy. Americans are now wary of what we call public culture and public institutions. They feel that it's much of the outside world, the public world, is somehow toxic, somehow polluted. We approach the world very often, the world when we leave our house or when we invite the world into our house through the media, which we do a lot. We approach it defensively. We're almost living defensively in that regard. And I think you can see this most plainly when you look at the way people parent compared to two or three generations ago, where parents of every ilk in this society, I believe, look at the world, the culture, what's on primetime TV, cable, lyrics, books, with a wariness that's new. I also find, apart from big culture, that we find our own behavior when we're in public, our own manners, to be honestly obnoxious. And not ourselves, but the guy next to us, the loudmouth who shoves the details of his latest dermatologist appointment into the phone while you're sitting next to him at a restaurant, the guy who clips his fingernails into the coffee shop downstairs here, thinks it's perfectly okay. The iPod zombies who walk around the streets or the stores with these devices in their ears that somehow make them impervious to the rest of human life. There's a kind of social obliviousness and boorishness among these people that makes them think we other earthlings don't exist. And I think that's something somewhat taxing to live around. That kind of bad behavior, I think we've been quite slow in noticing, is not unrelated to the behavior that we see in the leaders of our public institutions and our celebrities who we have grown so disenchanted with, the people who we love to hate in politics, in the media, in the celebrity world of Britney and Lindsay and Anna Nicole and the other characters that we love to hate. In one of the early chapters, I try to sort of categorize the ways that we hate our behavior and their behavior. I sort of call it the four B's to be on the lookout: BS, boorishness, belligerence, and balkanization. But what I'm not talking about is a kind of visceral red meat hate. I am not arguing that Americans dislike each other. I don't think we dislike our families, our relatives, our neighbors. It's more of a generalized feeling about the way we behave in public, the way the prevailing culture is, the us. You know, the we in the title is us as normal people, us as parents, employees, bosses, consumers. The us is the collective us. Somehow the collective us in America today is not reflecting the best in us, it's reflecting something a little bit lower. Americans certainly don't hate everything, but I would argue that everyone hates something. We all have our pet peeves, whether it's sophomoric sex humor in primetime TV or shows that, you know, make it to the top of the rankings because they're about autopsies or disgusting lyrics or cell phone louts, which I seem to not be able to get over. The other thing that's related to the pervasiveness of that is, since we all hate something, that could actually bring us together. I mean, we do have that much in common. I don't think you can go to any corner of the country and talk to, you know, as you might encounter sophisticated, lefty, yuppie people here talking about parenting and a homeschooling family in Kansas. When you talk about what we hate, especially related to the very personal issues of parenting, you see a lot of commonality, and that's something we miss. But the society, I think, has lost the confidence. The psychobabble word would be self-esteem, to impose any kind of standards on ourselves and to demand anything from what I would say are our higher selves. And that's both in terms of the behavior we would tolerate. Say, if there was somebody blaring on a cell phone here, would we confront them? Would we stop them? Do we demand more of our politicians somehow? Do we demand more of our primetime entertainment? Do we demand more of Hollywood? I don't think we're doing a very good job of that. And why is it? Is it just because American society is too big, too epic, too gargantuan? I also want to make another point about this book, which is that I think the entire language of American politics today is inadequate to even discuss the issues that I'm talking about. At this point, American politics, the great narrative of American politics, it's based on a myth. It's based on the idea that America is a polarized society between red and blue, liberal and conservative. And I think that notion is palpably untrue. The country is not divided in that way. And the great stories we hear from the media and from the politicians and the consultants perpetuate that. But what it has created is a vocabulary for talking about politics and political issues amongst ourselves, not just on TV. It's really a debate between the deaf. People who just talk past each other and don't hear. So what I've tried to write is a book that I would describe as non-political or apolitical or uber-political. I've tried not only to not be partisan, but to sort of not engage in those tired old political debates, because I just don't think that's an area where people can hear each other anymore. That's sort of the starting out point of what I tried to describe. So most of the book is taken up with trying to answer some of the questions that logically flow. First of all, is this phenomena that I'm writing about, is it new? Is it enduring? Is it different? Is it important, in other words? And I think, yeah, I think the answer to all of that is, I don't think the society has seen anything like that, like what we're having now, for a very, very long time. Obviously, we have tools of polling and social science that are new, that we didn't have 150 years ago. I think it's enduring because in many ways it's endured since the 1970s, and for our young country, that's a pretty long time. Secondly, is what I'm talking about important? Is it non-trivial? Non-trivial is a word that technologists like to use a lot of time. What I would like to argue is that on a social and a political level, the lack of confidence and trust that America has had sort of in itself, but certainly in the major institutions of society and the leaders of those institutions, have made it nearly impossible to solve what are very solvable problems in this country for the past 40 years. I mean, if you think about it in the grand sweep of history, you can make the very strong argument that there has been no landmark legislation that has addressed enduring major American problems since the 1960s. And I think that's a fairly embarrassing legacy. And I think that's tied to what I've called kind of our lack of national self-esteem. On a personal level, The culture that we live in, as I said, I believe now comes to represent the worst in us, not the best in us. In that atmosphere, I think there's a lot in the culture, especially in commercial culture, in marketing, that makes it very difficult to put our values in the right place. It makes it very easy to misplace our values and to actually think that the kind of hair conditioner you might use or the type of cracker that you might buy or the kind of car you have is actually related to your contentment as a human being on the planet. When you step back from those things, they're absurd. I mean, is having slightly drier hair, really gray hair, going to make you less happy? No. But there's a lot of that that's going on, and it's made it much more difficult to focus on what is important, what does make us feel content, what does make us feel authentic. A third issue, a philosophic issue that it was important to me consider, is related to what to me is the greatest sort of sociological, philosophic puzzle of our times, of the early 21st century and maybe later. We live at a time of historically huge and profound levels of material well-being in terms of longevity, the safety we live in, the safety from invasion, from enemies, from plagues, the health we have, the prosperity, the liberties, the options. Why are we not more content? Why are we disproportionately not more content compared to our material well-being? This isn't a phenomena, and I'm not just making this one up. I know it sounds like I am, but I'm not. This is something that sociologists and political scientists have spent a tremendous amount of time on. And it's a funny phenomena, but since the Second World War, in almost every Western industrialized democracy, as material well-being has increased, contentment has not. It's almost an inverse relationship, as if we get the practical skills of living prosperously, the skills of living meaningfully and spiritually and soulfully and happily have atrophied. Why are we less content than we were in the middle of the 20th century? And we are. There's no doubt about it. My conceit is that some of the stuff that's going on in the book, that I talk about in the book, is at that. Our practical cleverness has not been matched by our wisdom. And we have pursued false and phony pictures of what happiness is and of what the meaning of life is. There has been a vacuum because of a decline in traditional answers to those questions. There's been a vacuum, and I think it's been filled by all sorts of marketers, spiritual hucksters, political frauds, prophets of a kind of narcissism that is disguised as personal liberation. Finally, the obvious question is, well, why do we hate us and what has gotten here? And this is sort of where I get into my little theories about what's caused this. And I really want to stress, this is just my swing at this. This is not the kind of thing I'm saying, this is right, I can prove it, I got the data. This is my best take. To be perfectly honest, it's based more on intellectual history, it's based more on novels, it's based on my own human experience and my reporting, much more than it is polls and social scientists. My suggestion is that we've suffered from a kind of whammo, 1-2 punch of profound social change. The period symbolized by the 1960s brought about an intense and confrontational change in social habits, ideals, and thinking. And I mean this not the civil rights stuff. I mean, much of what happened in the 1960s obviously was extraordinary in terms of human progress. Huge groups in society were finally accorded rights and treatments of in being treated in civil ways that had never happened before. This isn't a bash the 60s kind of thing. But there was another thing that happened with the way people stitched together their lives, where they got the sources to find meaning in life. After the 60s and the post-60s period, there was this extraordinary revolution in technology, in communication technology, at the turn of the century with the internet boom, which I've been part of, God help me. And that has changed our lives in maybe less profound ways, but in many ways more practical ways. It's sped up the speed of our life. It's filled our life with data, with constant communication, with stimulus. It's made a big part of our life, not stuff that we experience one-on-one, talking to a human being or seeing something in front of it. It's stuff that comes into our lives on little screens that we carry on our belts and we play with when we're talking to other people. So what I'm saying is that on top of the spiritual and sort of social disorientation of the 60s, the American brain collided with the information revolution of the turn of the century and went boom. And what do we have? Well, you have the situation of Paris Hilton and Jimmy Swaggart and Newt Gingrich and John Edwards and 23-month-long presidential campaigns, TV shows about autopsies that are at the top of the charts, reality shows about the most demeaning things you could imagine, people undergoing plastic surgery to get ratings, loudmouths arguing on cable television, relentlessly parading as news and as journalism, yada, yada, yada. I think probably everybody in the room would be as capable of coming up with a Why We Hate Us list as I would. Basically, I just listened to what the people around me were complaining about, and I listed it, and that was that part of the book. Part of what was lost in America in the period that I'm saying is symbolized by the 1960s, I think is very easy to understand. Simple community. There's nothing fancy, there's nothing grandly intellectual about it. In the 60s and the 50s, in that period, Americans became more mobile. By choice, they chose, not like the pioneers and the immigrants who came to this country, we chose to leave our hometowns. A lot of times people had good reason to leave their hometowns. They were different. They were gay. They were minorities. They had parents who were rats, whatever. But it was a very, very different thing in human history to willingly choose to leave the place that was a community for you, where you had multi-generational relationships, where you knew your grandparents, where you knew the merchants you dealt with. And not only did people choose to leave their hometowns, they continued to want to move as adults. And Washington, in many ways, is a quintessential place for that. People, obviously, very few people are from here. My notion, and I think it's backed up by a lot of sociology, is that when people live among strangers, they tend to get pretty squirrely. I don't think it's a lot more complicated than that. The single greatest ingredient in human happiness, and there's really no dispute about this in social science, is the sheer volume and quality and quantity of warm human relationships. When those go down, human happiness shrinks and it diminishes. Where do you get those kinds of relationships? In stable, organic communities. I don't mean community with a capital C in some Marxist or socialist or new communitarian way. I mean it in the old-fashioned way. But another thing that was lost in the 1960s was a little harder for me to describe, and that was sort of the spiritual part of it. Because, as I said, there was enormous political and social progress in the 60s that we all benefit from. It was an amazing period, the last period of amazing progress in U.S. history. But nonetheless, something did change on a spiritual level. It had to do with losing key ingredients about how Americans have built and led lives that we are proud of, that we feel are natural, that we feel are authentic, that we feel aren't forced, that we feel aren't phony and invented. The phrase I termed, because I couldn't find anything else, was social inheritance. Social inheritance is an idea that sort of clashes violently with what I believe is the dominant but desperately failed modern existential recipe, the modern post-60s existential recipe, which I call selfism. And that's the idea that the existentially intense person, the honest person, goes out and, like a good consumer, chooses what we now call a lifestyle. You choose where to live, who to live with, whether to have children, whether to stay married, whether or not to be religious and then in what form, whether to stake a claim to your ethnicity, whether to retire to a tennis community or a golf community, whether to strongly affiliate with a designer label, whether it's Dolce & Gabbana or Armani or something. These are things that we've come to think are important. And you can make these choices on an unbelievable array of basic things about our lives. You can choose to have a big nose or a little nose, large breasts, small breasts, no breasts, huge breasts, big ears, wrinkles, no wrinkles. I mean, it would be very hard to come up with something that is not susceptible to a consumer choice in America today. And that's pretty bizarre in human history. The fundamental assumption, though, is that it's a variation on the ancient self-made man, you know, the Benjamin Franklin idea that you can create your own self. But when Benjamin Franklin was around, that could only exist within a community and within traditions of beliefs and morality, and now it's very different. And my argument simply is that selfism is a doomed project because happiness does not and it cannot come from within, which is contrary to probably what's in every self-help book in here. Happiness comes from other people. It comes from community. It comes from connection to other people. It comes from human effort. And I believe it comes from morality. And it can't exist without those ingredients. But to my surprise, I really couldn't describe this idea of social inheritance abstractly. And you've probably noticed that because I've been trying to describe it in an inarticulate, bumbling way as I've been in front of you. I found that I could only describe it in a very personal way, and that's the portion that I'd like to read very briefly to you before I wrap it up. This is a section of the book. It's in the third chapter. It's called Not a Trophy Wife, a Life. Freudian slip. I could pay pretty dearly for that, couldn't I? Not a trophy, life, with an L. A model of what I mean by social inheritance, and indeed what I think a modest, realistic view of community has been and can be, comes from my mother. Jean Gutman Meyer was born in 1923 in Highland Park, Illinois, then an affluent village 30 miles north of Chicago on Lake Michigan. Her parents both grew up in the Hyde Park neighborhood of Chicago. Both were German Jews whose ancestors had come over in the late 1840s or early 1850s. My mother moved just once growing up to a larger house a few blocks away. Her first cousins lived in the same town, and her grandparents lived in the city with a crowd of more distant relatives. Her parents' social lives revolved around a small country club where only other German Jews were members. My mom's social life was set up the same way when she was a girl and a young woman. She had few close friends who weren't the children of people in her parents' set. My mother's parents, like their parents and grandparents before them, were Reformed Jews. Her home and her life were entirely secular. Other Jews would say the family was assimilated, a disapproving description. There was no Jewish education, no synagogue, and the big family holiday was, and remains, a secular Christmas. My mother went to public schools in Highland Park and college in California until the impracticalities of frequent travel during World War II led her to finish up at Northwestern University in nearby Evanston, Illinois. My father also came from a family of German Jews who had been in the country since the 1850s, but his ancestors ended up in Richmond, Virginia. His family was acquainted with my mother's, and so when the Navy sent my father to midshipman school in Chicago to train for the war, he was invited to their home for Thanksgiving. They married right after the war and moved into a converted dog kennel on the grounds of a fancy house owned by close friends of my mother's family. My father went to work for my mother's father, who ran the leather tannery on the north side of Chicago that his grandfather had started in 1892. And it operated in the same location until 2007. My dad worked there until the day before he died. My parents settled in Glencoe, the town right next to Highland Park, and then stayed put. My mother died before my grandmother and never lived more than a few miles away from her. My mother's brother and his family lived one town over. A bunch of second cousins lived nearby. Our aunt and her family moved to Fargo, North Dakota, which was sad for my mother and my grandmother. Nearly all of my mother's friends were pals from her childhood. Her very best friend has stayed close to my family for at least 30 years after my mother died. My mother, of course, made other friends and close acquaintances as an adult, but the heart of her social life was the old gang. And when I was little, my friends were the children of her friends. The whole time I was growing up, Mom did volunteer work twice a week with kids who had mental disabilities. She had a cast-iron identity as a Jew. Her orbit was Jewish. And she felt Jews were marginalized people in society, but she was not at all observant. She was a devoted mother who made people feel very comfortable around her. She ran a house that kids' friends always wanted to play at. She lived a life that felt very natural to her. On Thursdays, my mom went to the beauty parlor and to the Jewel grocery store. She drove a station wagon with that funny fake wood paneling on the side. Her life was regular and common, though certainly privileged. Few women in her world needed to work, though some certainly did. The world my mom spent her whole life in was not exemplary in any way or especially worthy of mourning. It was a social world where it was hard to be different, though one that was tolerant of personal idiosyncrasies and eccentricity within her crowd. It was homogenous and unwelcoming to people who weren't white and heterosexual, though it did have a sort of don't ask, don't tell policy. My mother wasn't a shining star or a moral rebel in that conformist world. She wasn't a joiner or an energetic do-gooder. Mom was shy. She didn't like parties and big groups very much. She wasn't on the school board. She didn't organize amazing volunteer projects, entertain passing political candidates, or have a passionate avocation. She wasn't beloved by local orphans or widows. She truly and honestly didn't try to keep up with the Joneses, and that was her deliberate choice. Her head wasn't turned by what other people had or did. She didn't strive for her children to achieve and lead trophy lives. She never found occasion to reinvent herself. My mother was not a strikingly happy or driven person. She had some family problems, like most people. She had cancer for a very long time and died from it when she was only 53. She's buried at Rose Hill Cemetery in Chicago in a family plot that includes great-great-grandparents, great-grandparents, grandparents, parents, and sadly, a great-grandson. There are friends, cousins, aunts, and uncles all over the old cemetery. Life's challenges did little to rattle my mother's sense of herself. The meaning of her life, of what my father called her way of going, I think was, and I think this was because her world, the people, the proximity, the authenticity, the traditions, and the permanence quietly helped her. My mother had a social inheritance, and that was her real privilege. I'm going to skip just a few paragraphs. My three siblings and I all live in very different worlds from our mother. None of us stayed in that Chicago German-Jewish world, which barely exists anymore. We don't live near one another. Only one sister still lives in Chicago, a Chicago my parents didn't know, and her grown children live in North Carolina. I'm the only one of the four who is married to a Jew. None of us live in suburbs. We live in cities in the country. None of us has ever remotely considered joining a country club. We each have a few friends from childhood, but they aren't in our daily lives except through the phone and email. Luckily, I think the four of us did inherit my mother's fundamental moral sensibility and a love of her family traditions. That is part of a social inheritance. But most aspects of our outward lives resulted from very free and deliberate decisions, almost like consumer choices. Our mother was free to make such choices in theory, but they would have seemed weird, affected, and unnatural to her. But we had no alternative. We had to earn our social capital. Most people do now. So the risk of reading that passage is that you'll all just think that I'm a hopeless nostalgic, or that I'm just a griper, the secret love child of Andy Rooney, with no solutions to offer. But honestly, you will have to read the book to find out if all that's true. So now I thank you and take your questions.
Well, this is all a little abstract for me, but I'm about your age. My parents were born in 1923, and the kind of community I grew up in, like the kind of community you grew up in, is gone. And families are smaller. Jobs are more difficult to get. When in the 60s, we all assumed that a job was no problem, and women assumed that marriage was no problem. Well, now marriage is a big problem. My husband died 10 years ago, and I haven't been able to find anyone.
You hear that, everyone?
I'll say it again. So I think we can't go back. We have to go forward, and it's not going to be so easy to create new communities. And we may have to find some other solution. Also, people are anxious in a way that they were not in the 60s, or many people are, middle-class people are. I mean, there's globalization. It's much more threatening. It's clear individuals have much less control over their lives than even they did in the 50s and the 60s.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think we have underestimated what simple community is, and I think we have underestimated that to have it takes effort. It takes brutal effort every day. I mean, my wife and I, neither of us are from here. We've had to forge our own community. We're very lucky. We have a fantastic one. But to think that it's going to happen, I think, is naive. And I also think that, you know, there's a lot of evangelists, especially in my business, who believe it can happen with new technology, that there can be virtual communities. And I think wonderful things can happen with technology. I mean, for instance, cancer patients can talk to each other in a way that they couldn't 40 years ago. To think that that can be a substitute for human contact in the same room, I think, is naive.
I'm really excited that you bring up this topic because I think it is very important. I'm not sure, though, that I get a sense of you're really dealing with it. Now, because of the extreme quick changes in technology and all this stuff, we have flipped, and we haven't been able to reprogram ourselves to align with this flipping of different opportunities and different ways of approaching life. And that is my understanding of why we're going astray right now. We have to sit back and reflect what it is we want, where we want to go, and how are we going to go up against vested interests that don't want to have that happen.
I do have some ideas. I'm loath to suggest prescriptions because, frankly, in this society, the person who comes forward with the answers, I believe, is automatically discredited. The most profound thing that I believe is those who look for answers from the government, from the media, from anybody but yourself are misguided. One of the books that I use a lot for odd reasons is Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. And there's a beautiful quote in that book where towards the end of his journey, he says he's come to believe that the world will only get better by individuals making quality choices. And what he means by quality choices are essentially authentic and honest choices. And that's really what I believe, and that's what I try to express at the end of the book. I don't think that they will come up with any answers. I think it will come from people like this, being teachers, being colleagues, being bosses, being parents, being aunts, being uncles, making quality, thoughtful, effortful choices every day, and maybe someday something will come from that. Just the other thing that I'll touch on briefly, you're talking about how in the face of all of this marketing and all this info schmutz, it's very hard to create mindful approach to time and to a life philosophy. It's great hubris to think that you can do that on your own without the help of a community, without the help not just of a community of actual people, but a spiritual community. And in America, what a spiritual community is has always been a muddle because it's been the secular mix. It's been like the Protestant work ethic maybe combined with Catholicism, combined with your Methodist or your Judaism. It's always kind of been a hodgepodge, but it was something that existed very strongly in communities and in families. Once you sort of throw that out and say, hey, you know, that's a cop-out to go to somebody else's rules. I'm going to make my own rules. It's become very, very difficult. And I think the basic recipe that we have been told is the path to authenticity and existential intensity since the 60s has been a bill of goods.
I agree with you completely with the desirability of moving towards more organic communities. Where I believe I have a disagreement is the need for leadership to take on the issues, you know, without the visionary leadership to really take on these issues, I don't see how the world will ever go back to that type of community.
I'd love to have it. I just don't see it coming very easily. And I also think there's something very strange about society today, which is the way information changes, exchange between human beings is very different. The amount of media in today's society, it's enormous. And it is unclear to me whether character, leadership, can survive the giant Cuisinart that is the sort of political media machine. I mean, when you have a 23-month campaign and you have these guys, every burp and word and gesture dissected endlessly by people talking about it, how can somebody's human dignity be preserved through that? I mean, my sense is that Barack Obama and John McCain are men of great character and guts, and they're real public servants. But somehow, you know, now McCain is running ads comparing Barack Obama to Britney Spears. How can human dignity endure that kind of process? But, yeah, I'd love to have the leadership, and count me in if you find it.
a note of dissent. When I heard you talk about organic communities, I think of Iraq, which consists of clans and ethnic and religious organic communities that are at constant war with each other. I think it is a wonderful country that we have, that you can transcend your origins of class, race, and so forth, and rise, okay? And I think the price we pay for that, I agree with you that nothing is free, but I'd rather pay that price than duplicate what's going on in the clan-based organization in Iraq. I do quarrel with your remedy and that we've given up something so precious that the price we pay is too great for what we've achieved. I disagree with that.
It's certainly not possible to go back to the way things were, and it's not desirable. It's a silliness. I do think the society has been cavalier in looking at what the costs of its mobility have been, its mobility geographically and spiritually. I don't think that the lesson of human history is that you can only have community where it exists in a violent, balkanized way, like Eastern Europe or Iraq. I mean, I think there are many counterexamples to that, and I think the United States has been a counterexample to that in many ways. Obviously, the whole idea of American exceptionalism, the whole idea that America was founded on, was that an individual was not shackled to his class, to his parents' profession, to their religion in forming their future. I mean, that is what has made America extraordinary. That is why immigrants still want to come here. That is why probably the solutions that I'm talking about will be addressed more agilely than in any other society. But I think it's naive to think that the costs have been minor. So maybe we don't disagree quite so much. Thank you all for your questions. I appreciate it.
Thanks for joining us on Book Tour. For more readings and discussions like this one, please visit npr.org/booktour.